Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. Most of us live in fairly consistent 24-hour cycles. We go to bed at the same time, wake up at the same time, work at the same time. There is a rhythm to our lives. It's the daily circadian time cycle, the biological or body clock. When that rhythm is disrupted even a little bit, things can change. We can get cranky, have difficulty shaking the cobwebs, are less efficient performing basic tasks. It can happen when we jet across time zones, perform shift work, or even when we shift to and from daylight saving time. That's because our brains are in delicate balance between when we're asleep and when we're not. When that balance is disrupted, we feel it. I'm Don Marsh. We're talking about that on today's program with two Washington University professors who are studying the process. They are biology professor Eric Herzog and Paul Gray, assistant professor of anatomy and neurobiology. Also with us is Lieutenant Rodney Hall of the Edwardsville Fire Department. He works a shift of 24 hours on and 48 off. We'll see how he is affected by that. Gentlemen, thanks so much for being with us. Nice to see you all.
Thanks for having me.
Eric, let me start with you. I've referenced the biological clock a number of times, and when I do it and a woman is around, she thinks I'm talking about the time frame in which she can conceive. But that's the term you use in the work that you're doing. I use body clock, for instance, and others talk about circadian rhythm. Give us the definition of your biological clock.
Good. So we define the biological clock as an entity within the body that synchronizes to an environmental cycle, something like the annual cycle or a daily cycle, or for some marine organisms, the tidal cycle or the lunar cycle. So a woman's biological clock, when she hears it ticking and feels that urge to have a child, is a very different process. It's not synchronized to an environmental astrological cycle.
Paul, where is this clock? I mean, it's our brain. Is our brain is ticking off for us?
Well, the main clock in terms of our everyday experience is located in a very small population of cells at the base of the hypothalamus. So the other parts of the brain are involved in automatic behaviors, involved in sort of sleep-wake, all of your food intake. But there's a specific place called the suprachiasmatic nucleus of the hypothalamus, and that's what the master regulator of all the body clock, of the entire body's 24-hour cycle. Importantly, though, your liver has the capacity to have its own clock. So there are free-flowing clocks essentially in multiple places in your body, which the clock in your brain synchronizes sort of every day to make sure everybody's on the same page in terms of what time of the day it is.
To keep with this metaphor, Eric, what is winding this clock?
So we think of the clock as a timer like on your wristwatch. It can run all by itself, and it'll run forever as near as we can tell, even if you take it out of the body and put it into a dish. But when we think about how it needs to be set to local time, it needs to get information from the environment to wind, to synchronize to the local schedule.
What does the sun have to do with it, if anything?
So in mammals, we receive light information through our eyes, and that information about dawn and dusk is essential for us to synchronize to the normal light-dark schedule. Many blind people, for example, complain about being able to synchronize to local schedules and to get to work on time.
Paul, how did all of this evolve, or has it been fairly constant as far as we know through time?
Well, as far as we can know, pretty much every organism has a biological clock or 24-hour clock, or at least complex organisms. There's some interesting work looking at what the mechanism of 24-hour clock are in sort of simpler organisms, and Eric can probably describe this a little bit more. In terms of sort of the mammalian body clock or the animal body clock, we know that at least the suprachiasmatic nucleus, that there's similar populations in mammals as well as in fish and birds and other species. And one would make a prediction that they're all sort of coming from a sort of really early precursors in brain evolution. Mm-hmm. The clocks themselves, the details of the genes that are associated with the clock are actually very, very old. Most of the genes themselves predate or sort of begin at the level of multicellular organisms. So how they combine together to produce the 24-hour clock is still sort of a very interesting question. But, at some level, the parts of the clock are all really old, and the parts that we use to generate our own clock are also probably also very, very old. So whether that's the original purpose of these genes or whether that's a derived function of these genes that have sort of been taken over due to this entrainment of the 24-hour cycle.
Eric, anything you want to add to that in terms of the evolution?
Yeah, Paul's right that if you look across vertebrates, it looks like the genes that are involved are highly conserved. But you can even go all the way back to single-celled organisms, perhaps those that were the first to live on this planet, and they have a near 24-hour timer, a circadian clock. And it turns out the genes that we look for in vertebrates or in animals are not there in those early organisms. And so it looks like the clock has probably evolved independently several times. At least the clock as we understand it right now probably evolved once in early protozoan single-celled organisms. Then it evolved independently in plants. And then it evolved again independently in fungi and then animals. So maybe four times the clock has happened.
What is its purpose?
It helps you anticipate what's coming next. And since you live on this really wonderfully predictable planet where we're just going to keep rotating around our axis and dawn is going to come tomorrow at a very predictable time, it helps you get everything in order. Just like making a cake, you want to get all the ingredients out on the counter, assemble them in the right order, put them in the oven at the right time, at the right temperature. You get the right product at the end. So we need to anticipate when we're going to be waking up, when we're going to be eating, when we need to avoid predators, when it's going to be time to make love. Everything about our lives is coordinated by this master clock.
And Paul, if these things don't happen at the right time, what is happening to us? How do we react to what's not happening?
Well, you know, if you sort of get out of sync, maybe that would be the next question. Because the clock itself will keep sort of running and, you know, it'll tell you by and large when you should be going to sleep, when you should be getting up. If because of our busy lives or because, you know, there's some – I have to watch however many episodes of whatever the latest thing on Netflix is. You're up all night. you know, if you leave that cycle, you know, that has a number of consequences. You know, obviously, one, you don't get the right amount of sleep or you're uncomfortable. But there are also aspects of, you know, changes to – long-term changes to blood pressure, changes in how we, you know, respond to blood sugar on our diets. So – it just depends. A short-term effect, you know, the 24-hour or an hour because you switch the daylight saving time may have a small effect. But, you know, a continuous sort of long-term or abrupt changes a lot can actually have a lot of effects essentially on how we are healthy, how healthy one is. I mean, maybe Rodney has some discussion in terms of, you know, what involved, you know, how do you feel after you have to sort of switch your schedule that abruptly on a regular basis?
That's why I raised that question, because I want to get Rodney into the conversation. Well, what do you think about what you've heard so far, and how is your life affected by this strange schedule of yours?
Well, what I've heard so far is nothing I've heard before and a little over my head, but I can tell you from experience, as far as the physical aspect, I was discussing with them in the green room. Up until about 2 years ago, I made a lifestyle change. Before that, I had gained quite a bit of weight, was not living a healthy lifestyle, and I suffered because of it. I've been 18 years now. I've worked this shift. And when I was young, I could be up most of the night, get woke up several times and come home and still have a productive day. Up until a few years ago when I really became unhealthy, if I had a bad night at work, when I came home, almost every shift when I got off, I would have to lay down for at least a couple hours. And since I've made the change and started eating better and trying to keep on some type of cycle, even with the call volumes, which I have no way to control, I've kind of gotten my body back into a cycle, and a lot of that has now disappeared, and I'm able to have a productive first day off, even if I have somewhat of a bad night.
So you attribute the health and the health problems that you are experiencing to this cycle that you are on?
Oh, I do. What I would eat, I was eating a lot of fast food, eating it all hours, you know, day and night. If I got back from a call and it was midnight, you know, running and grabbing, you know, a cheeseburger and drinking a soda, and I didn't feel good. And the next morning I would even feel it. So cutting that out has made a big difference.
And then you said you would you kind of regroup the following day, the first part of the 48 hours that you were off. What about day two?
Day two, I'm usually pretty good. I have always been a night person, so I've had difficulties falling asleep. So one of my problems has always been if I come home from a bad night and I lay down for 2 or 3 hours, my cycle gets off to where that night, where I normally would have gone to bed at 10:30, I would lay in bed and it would be 2 o'clock in the morning and I could not fall back asleep. So I'm better if I don't get that nap during the day, and then I'm able to go back into my cycle, and by the second day then I'm usually good.
What about your peers on the job? Do they have the same sort of experience? Do they talk about how their cycles change?
A little bit, and everybody's bodies are different. I've worked with some people that I don't think they ever went to sleep. I don't know how they functioned. We have a lot of callback overtime, and some of these gentlemen that would seem like they were just always there, and other guys, I know talking to them that they just don't handle the lack of sleep very well, and you know they will sleep when they get home the next morning.
Eric, you've heard stories like this before, obviously, and your research, I'm sure, has covered a lot of this. What do you think about what he's just said?
Yeah, what Rodney's describing is pretty typical for folks on different kinds of shift work schedules. And if you talk to different people in different industries, you'll hear about different shift work schedules. This schedule of 24 on, 48 off is typical for some firefighters and police forces. Others are on very different schedules. And it's important to start to understand which shift schedules might actually be compatible with our biological clock and which are clearly in defiance of what our clock is telling us to do.
I've never fully understood why people go on these extreme shifts. Perhaps you can tell me, Rodney, why we have to have it this way. We talk of doctors, young doctors who are on 24-hour shifts. That can't be efficient.
Well, with us, now, where I work, the city of Edwardsville, you know, we don't have the call volume of larger cities, you know, even St. Louis City and New York and Chicago. And there are some departments that work 12-hour shifts because of their call volume. So for us, we have usually sufficient downtime. A normal workday for us, you know, I start at 7:30 in the morning till 5 p.m. We have daily duties, we have inspections, and we're up doing stuff. After that, we have downtime unless there's a call. So you're able to relax. You know, we are able to sleep, although it does, you know, get interrupted quite a bit. But we are not at a volume to where, you know, we are no longer efficient at our jobs. But some places, they're truly, you know, is that aspect, and they've tried to address it. And as far as the 24-hour shifts, I actually spoke with my Chief Welly, about why this came to be. And, you know, it's kind of a tradition in the fire service, and FLSA has actually made an exemption for this fire service to allow a 53-hour work week. Which our department, we're at a 52.3-hour work week is what our standard shift is. So it's always been this kind of tradition. And, you know, the firefighters used to live in the firehouse, and it kind of evolved from that. So it's pretty unique. And when I tell people I'm on that schedule, they kind of, you know, do a double take, like how do you function for 24 hours? And the hope is that we're not up for the entire 24 hours.
I've got to take a break. Why don't I come back and pick up with the two professors on some of the things you've just said here. We'll continue our discussion about the biological clock. I call it the body clock, but biological clock is the term that officially is being used by our guests, Professors Eric Herzog, biology professor at Washington University. Paul Gray is assistant professor of anatomy and neurobiology at the same university. And Lieutenant Rodney Hall from the Edwardsville Fire Department, from whom you just heard, is also with us in studio. Back to continue this discussion, we'll be looking for your questions and comments in just a couple of moments at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. You can send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org or send us a tweet at STL on Air. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back to our discussion about the biological clock, the rhythm of our day, and how our lives are affected by any changes, subtle or otherwise, in that rhythm. I want to pick up on a point, Eric. I'll start with you and then to you, Paul, with regard to this schedule that Rodney was just telling us about. Do you think it's possible to be efficient at the end of a 24-hour cycle like that, whether it's a firefighter, a policeman, or a doctor?
I think the answer is yes, it is possible. I was encouraged to hear that Rodney's force does encourage them to take naps if they can. That is not approved in all industries. So, for example, air traffic controllers are not allowed to take naps on their breaks. And the quotes that come out of that industry are, you know, we don't pay people to nap.
But they don't work in 24-hour cycles, do they?
But they do work in hours outside of your standard 9 to 5, and they are tired on the job. So I think we acknowledge that, you know, working outside the standard daytime hours is difficult for most people, and most people will flag, and their attention and their well-being will deteriorate.
Paul, is a nap in the middle of all of this constructive or destructive? It too, is disruptive of whatever cycle you're on.
Well, you know, as Rodney was saying, there are this is a question of sort of sleep pressure, which is, you know, how tired do you have to be before you can go to sleep? So in some cases, if you take a nap, it's especially good to get a full sort of REM cycle in, which is, you know, even on a shorter time stare, there is a rhythm of your sleeping. Right, so you'll actually have probably somewhere around a 90-minute cycle where you can get through your full sort of all your REM sleep from slow wave all the way through. And getting a full REM cycle is good. So a good nap is good. A half an hour nap may not be that constructive.
Explain the REM cycle to those who don't know what you're talking about.
All right. So when you sleep, and you can see this in your pets sometimes too, where they'll be twitching, you'll have different stages of sleep. You know, you have early sleep, which is, you know, basically when you've fallen asleep. Then you'll have a slow wave sleep, which is somewhat of a very deep sleep. And this is very similar to what you see children have, these sort of very, very deep sleep that, you know, you can't – it's difficult to wake them out of. As you get older, that deep sleep sort of fragments a little bit. And then they'll have a REM sleep where, if you're paying attention, you know, you'll see a flickering of muscles. And this is primarily when you do most of your dreaming, at least from a personal experience. But that full cycle is, you know, you basically go through a full cycle, and you do a number of these cycles during the day, and it's getting a full cycle is important and actually useful. Sometimes sort of having a short nap or very fragmented sleep can actually be sort of counterproductive. Now, you know, just quickly, one of the things that Rodney was talking about that's good is you can, if you have one of these cycles, there are things that you can do to try to make sure that you get on schedule, which is, you know, get some sunlight, you know, be very regular about when you eat and what kinds of things that you can eat. So you can mitigate at least some of the difficulties if you maintain a good scheduling of your own sort of personal life.
A two-part question, Eric. Are people are affected differently by all of this? I'm going to react differently to that schedule than he did. And is age a factor? Do any of these things change as we get older, for instance?
Absolutely. So the genetics are being understood now more and more. We've identified about 8 genes that are clearly involved in just the circadian clock and its timing, which opens a window that tells you it's now a good time to go to sleep. And as we've emphasized here, there are sort of 2 processes that are regulating your sleep. Your regular daily schedule, which is regulated by this biological clock, and then this homeostat or hourglass, which is measuring every minute of the day that you've been awake, and right now you're progressively getting more and more sleep debt that you will have to pay back tonight when you go to sleep. And it looks like, for the most part, those are separable biological processes. And Paul and I study the biological clock primarily, and we don't study so much this homeostat or hourglass that's measuring how long you've been awake. So the genes that are involved in timing of when you go to sleep, those genes, for example, the period 2 gene has been identified in fruit flies, mice, and humans as being really important in telling you whether you're going to be an early bird or a late bird. And it turns out late birds deal better with late schedules, and they can deal with sleep deprivation better.
I wanted to get to that. Rodney mentioned he was a night person, did you say, or a day?
Yeah, I always have been. Even as a child, I remember I just could not fall asleep, you know, at the time I was supposed to be in bed.
I've heard people say that all of my life, and I was never quite sure if that really existed. There is such a thing as a day person and a night person.
Absolutely, absolutely. So, for example, there's a family in Utah that was discovered. They didn't complain, but they showed up in a sleep clinic, and they wake up very early in the morning. They wake up, in fact, at about 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning every day without an alarm clock. They go to bed every night at about 7 o'clock at night. They have a different version of the PER2 gene. They have a different polymorphism. And that is what we think is causing them to synchronize to the light-dark schedule in a way that they wake up really early. So they're extreme early birds.
We have an email. You mentioned a sleep clinic from Jeff in St. Louis. He says, for 5 years, I've been working with a sleep clinic trying to establish normal hours, and I'm having a heck of a time getting there. Is there any hope that lifelong sleep patterns can be effectively changed? What do you think, Paul?
Well, currently there aren't any good drugs, and I don't know of any sort of magic bullet for improving your sleep patterns. And as it normally stands, basically what they do is you want to sort of regulate your life in a way that you're getting up at the same time, you're getting enough sleep or trying to get enough sleep, that you eat at the sort of right time and you eat the right kinds of food. But most of it is, so we haven't found a way to really sort of control sleep in a way that you would like to be able to, say, control other aspects of your life. If you take a sleep medication, sometimes that can help you get to sleep, but it's not the same thing as falling asleep. It doesn't necessarily have the same quality of sleep that one would like. And, as Eric was saying, we know a lot more about the sort of genetics and circuitry of the circadian rhythm. Right now, we're just sort of early times in trying to really understand the actual detailed mechanisms of sleep itself.
We've mentioned circadian rhythm a couple of times. I mentioned it in the introduction. Again, just to be sure that everyone listening knows what we're talking about, Eric, it's the 24-hour daily cycle.
Right? Exactly. It's that thing that wakes you up in the morning if you don't use an alarm clock on the weekends. And I wanted to add to Paul's comment, since this email came from someone at a sleep clinic and trying to work on his sleep schedule, it's intriguing that there are thousands and thousands of sleep clinics across the world. There are no circadian clinics. So even though this is an exciting new field of biology and understanding this clock is something that we're making great strides at, we are not seeing it translated into clinical practice at this point. We don't see a lot of physicians thinking about new therapies for disorders of the circadian clock.
You're not talking about trying to change this clock at all. You're talking about teaching people how to deal with it.
Well, they're both, I think. The idea that if you understand how your personal clock, this would be personalized medicine at its best, how it likes to synchronize, we might be able to give you advice, very specific advice, about when to see light, when to take your meals, when to avoid light, when to avoid particular foods, and how to keep a schedule that might make you feel better. And Rodney is sort of self-medicated and told us about how he lost 40 pounds at least and by putting himself on a very regular schedule that works with his 24 hours on and then 2 days off.
But what you've just described is really accommodating a personal clock, your own personal clock, as opposed to changing. Is it possible to change that cycle so that you can do things at different times and don't have to follow the clock?
Well, so I don't think you can disobey your clock and live to appreciate that success. The most extreme examples are if you put a rodent on a continuously shifting schedule, every 2 weeks shift the schedule by 6 hours. So they have to wake up 6 hours earlier. After 2 weeks, you shift the schedules again by 6 hours. You do that, those mice will die prematurely of many, many disorders, including dysfunctions in their body weight, their cardiovascular system, their immune system. Many things begin to fail prematurely. So right now, we don't have any way to disobey the clock, but I would say that we have ways that you can help yourself. So for example, if you're a traveler, a business traveler crossing time zones, you're forcing yourself to synchronize to a new schedule every time you land in a new time zone. There are things we can tell you to help you with your travel so you'll synchronize more rapidly on your next trip to Paris.
Thank you very much. When am I leaving? What is the most serious illness you think that someone, a human, forget the mice for a moment, that a human might be exposed to in defying the clock?
Maybe the question is it's not really possible to defy the clock is the problem. I mean, the clock is, 400 million years of evolution writ large, right? I mean, it's as functional as it's sort of like defying your kidneys, right? It is a integral part of who you are and how you deal with the environment. So, I mean, I think the best that you can do is try to accommodate to your clock and to your environment. But, you know, as Eric was saying, as Rodney was saying, the issue is if you do decide you want to live in a different cycle than your clock is suggesting, that will lead to decreased sleep. It will lead to, you know, increased weight. It'll lead to poor aspects of blood pressure control. I mean, it will have, you know, sort of consequences on your overall health that aren't going to be sort of really robust and very obvious, but they're going to they will accumulate over time.
Over time, that high blood pressure could lead to a cardiac issue of some sort.
But even within just 3 days of a disrupted schedule, we see signs of pre-diabetic symptoms.
Wow. This is important research you're doing, and needless to say, let's go to the phones. I want to bring in Tim, who's calling from St. Louis. Tim, thanks for being with us. Go ahead.
Hi, good day to you all. I am a classical musician, and I've noticed how my sort of macro schedule is affected by the things I have to do. But I'm curious if your guests have anything to say about how musicians entrain to time specifically. I've noticed, for example, that I could hear the first few seconds of a piece of music and then not listen to it for several minutes, and even several minutes later, I'll be exactly with the piece. So I'm curious if they have anything to say about that sort of process.
So that aspect of fast time, which is on a time scale sort of very, very different from this 24-hour clock that you're normally experiencing, so that part of time is probably involves a different parts of the brain than the circadian oscillator. These are parts of the cerebellum which are involved and very important both in motor control, which as a musician you probably have very good detail with, but as well as aspects of understanding and being able to control sort of rapid time. So while it's a measure of time, the details of the neurons in the brain that are actually controlling it are very different. And the mechanisms by which you can handle that time are probably also very different just because of the time scale that we're talking about.
Okay.
And I can just add one small comment. The clock we're talking about has a 24-hour period, and the periods that a musician's thinking about are very fast. And a fun game you can play is close your eyes and try to estimate the passage of, let's say, 60 seconds. And you'll find you're pretty accurate at that at certain times of day. But try it again in the very early morning or the very late night, just before you go to bed or just after you've woken up, and you'll find that your perception of the time passing is different, and you'll overestimate or underestimate a minute. And that's the effect of this clock that we've been talking about today.
You know, I have heard that the State Department actually has a policy if they're flying a diplomat to be involved in negotiations through several time zones. Those negotiations are not allowed to begin for at least 24 hours because at the end of that time, they can't even add a simple column of two figures. Am I right on that?
We can show – so disruptions like that where you're traveling across many time zones and trying to perform at times when you're not regularly performing can be quite significant. You can make bad judgments. The Olympic teams now have consultants on travel. The Celtics have hired a chronobiologist, somebody who studies circadian time, to advise them on when to travel, when to practice, and when to play.
You know, it's occurred to me in watching the Cardinal baseball teams, when they travel to the West Coast, it seems to me almost invariably they lose the first game. And I've always thought it's because of the time change. That's possible.
Well, just travel in itself puts you at a disadvantage. Being the home team gives you an advantage, right? But it turns out there was a paper in 1993 that studied 3 years' worth of baseball statistics published in the top scientific journal, Science, showing that, in fact, teams that travel east are at a disadvantage significantly. If you want to win as a bettor, you bet against the teams that travel east. I'll confide in you that I've been using this strategy in the NCAA basketball tournament for the last 10 years. I haven't won a dollar yet.
Well, nice try anyway. Rodney, what do you think about all of this? As a man who's for 18 years, I think you said, you've been on this strange schedule.
Yes, 18 years I've worked. And actually, I want to back up when you were talking about the blood pressure and some of these issues that can come out of it. There are several of my coworkers that are young, I would say early 30s, that we have an annual physical, and it's been caught that they have high blood pressure and they have cholesterol issues to the point to where they've been placed on medication. And, you know, it's very odd. And to look at them, you know, their outward appearance, you would, you know, think that they're pretty, you know, in shape guys. And then all of a sudden they get these results back, and now they're on medications for it. And that's really young to be, you know, dealing with that, in my opinion.
On the basis of what you've been hearing today, I mean, would you be inclined to say, gee, we ought to take a look at this Edwardsville and maybe think about changing the way we're doing business in the fire department?
Well, I would say, again, back to our call volume, I don't think it's so severe that we need to do anything like that. Well, one thing we do have that we are at a big advantage is our city is very proactive, and they have a health and wellness program that they've started with us. And, you know, I think that would help to curb a lot of this. And now, you know, you're going to get out of it what you put into it. So that could be the issue. But with our department, we have mandatory physical fitness. You're supposed to do at least 60 minutes a day. We have a personal trainer that we meet with once a month. We have resources that are available. We have a gym. You know, and, you know, a lot of it comes from curbing work comp issues with back injuries and a lot of these other common injuries that we see. But, you know, another aspect should be to help out with these issues that can derive from lack of sleep.
Eric, will that do it, the exercise and what he has just described?
Scheduled exercise can certainly help, and keeping yourself on a very regular schedule, listening to your biological clock as much as possible. I'd love to see that we added that sort of advice into that regular physical. And I think as we start to see that adopted by people who really feel it, like physicians and firefighters and paramedics, I think it'll become more standard for the rest of us. Another place I'd love to see that sort of change is in school times.
I wanted to get to that. We have to take another break. We hear an awful lot about teenagers getting that early start when they probably shouldn't be because of this whole thing that we're talking about, this circadian rhythm and biological clock. Have to take another break. We'll come back and continue the conversation. Rodney, I know you have to go. If you want to leave during this break, that's fine. If you can stay with us a few more minutes, that's fine, too. I'll leave it up to you.
Okay.
All right, great. Okay, we'll be back in just a moment. My guest in studio, Eric Herzog, biology professor at Washington University, Paul Gray, assistant professor of anatomy and neurobiology at Washington University, and Lieutenant Rodney Hall of the Edwardsville Fire Department. We're talking about the biological clock, the rhythm of our lives. Back in just a moment, this is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back. Before we resume our conversation on the biological clock, here are some of the stories our St. Louis Public Radio newsroom is following today. Officials from the Missouri State Fair and the Rodeo Cowboy Association are reacting to the controversy over a clown act at the fair, most consider insulting to President Obama. Missouri Governor Nixon will make an appearance in Kirkwood this afternoon, defending his veto of the income tax bill. And the United Mine Workers of America has reached a settlement with St. Louis-based Patriot Coal over wages, health care, and pension benefits. These stories and more this afternoon on St. Louis Public Radio and throughout the day at stlpublicradio.org. Now back to the conversation about the biological clock, circadian rhythm, the body clock, whatever. Paul, let me go to you with this with regard to the young people, the teenagers. A lot of schools are changing their hours to let these youngsters have a little more time to sleep. What's going on here? Why is this necessary?
Well, I mean, studies have shown, especially teenagers, they just really need to wake up a little bit later. You know, they run into two problems. One, they're not getting enough sleep. They're going to bed too late. But also that there's just some aspect of their own individual circadian clock such that they would be more productive if school were not to start, say, at 7 or 8, but maybe shift it closer to 9 o'clock in the morning and go a little bit later in the afternoon. And, you know, at this point, basically any little bit to sort of improve how you're doing in school would be a good one, and that's a relatively simple one, but it has been shown in certain studies that it's actually pretty effective, at least in improving, you know, how awake the students are, if nothing else.
Eric, some schools are actually doing this, but the vast majority are not. This would be a recommendation, I suppose, is that they have this later start time.
Right. And the justification is really just to look at the schedule the students keep during the week compared to the weekend. And what we see is that they'll shift their schedule by as many as 4 to 6 hours on a Saturday or a Sunday compared to Monday through Friday. And this is a form of social jet lag. It's society imposing on them a schedule that they have to shift to, and their biological clock can't quite accomplish it. And so they're experiencing on a weekly basis jet lag in the way that shift workers would be experiencing.
And kind of experiencing the kind of life that that Rodney is living here.
I would make one distinction with the way Rodney's living, and I don't want folks to think that Rodney's killing himself.
He looks in pretty good shape to me.
he's doing very well, and I think in part because he is on a regular schedule that does fit with his body clock. We're asking him to stay up much longer than he would prefer to. His clock would like him to get sleep, and sometimes because we're a 24/7 society, we're running things around the clock. But at least he's not shifting his schedule dramatically on a regular basis. And I'd be curious to hear what Rodney says about what his schedule is on his 2 days off following his 24 hours on, if it's a big difference.
Well, the last year has been, because I also have a new child at home. So
I think we all have it.
He just turned one, and that kind of, you know, has messed everything up again. But before that, I did have a routine, and my wife and I, you know, we were pretty set on it, and pretty much didn't avoid it. The only other issue that we have is that with my department, they do a lot of callbacks. So even though my days off, you know, in theory should be my days off, if there is a fire in town or something does happen that they need more resources, we do get called back. So, you know, it could be my second night. Now I'm up for another 10 hours, 8 hours overnight dealing with that issue. But for the most part, I have a pretty good routine that I stick to. And, you know, I don't feel the lag, and you know, unless I have a really bad night. I used to be able to tell it, and like my cognitive function and everything used to be decreased, and I don't see that since I changed my lifestyle.
You mentioned the baby, and Paul, you know, I didn't even think about that, but of course a young baby is disruptive. They get up in the middle of the night, cause parents to get up in the middle of the night. This is a problem. Well, beyond just being inconvenient.
Well, it's also not the baby's fault, per se, because, you know, one of the things we've talked about, how ubiquitous our biological clocks are. Well, you know, in babies, it's not really set up yet, right? It takes a little while after the you know, humans are born before that biological clock really starts to kick in. So, you know, the fact that you sort of, your infant is sleeping 2 hours on, 1 hour off, you know, throughout the night, and you're pulling your hair out, you know, part of that is just because as time will go along, the biological clock is maturing. And this happens in essentially all mammals, at least to the extent they've been studied. And there's a maturation state. So the neurons within the nucleus, the suprachiasmatic nucleus, are there. But the connections, the wiring, isn't quite ready yet. So it takes some time. And part of that is, so as your child gets to a more regular schedule. And here, especially, this idea of sleep hygiene for infants is important, to put them on as regular a schedule as you possibly can to help that clock sort of mature and go into the direction that you would like.
You're a better person than I am. I wasn't thinking of the baby. I was thinking of the parents and how they're disrupted by this.
Absolutely, yeah. So during those 3 months when the clock is maturing in the baby, the parents are fully mature but not able to synchronize to their regular schedule, and they're praying for the day when everybody's going to become diurnal again and active during the day and getting a full night's sleep.
Yeah. I guess every parent has been through that and knows exactly what you're talking about. Let's bring in another caller. Jerry in O'Fallon, Missouri, joins us. Go ahead, Jerry.
Good morning. In my previous life, I worked in the airline business, specifically in safety and accident analysis, things like that. And what amazed me is going back, the military, we had access to information and studies and experiments that the military carried out going back to the 40s and 50s. And the bottom line is, like you're saying, you know, we have a certain amount of productivity. Most of us, majority of us really are not meant to work at night. We're certainly not meant to work these extremely long shifts, and often in the transportation business, that's coupled with a relatively short night. And then the double whammy is, if you're flying transcontinental or certainly transoceanic, you're throwing in a big change in your time zone with no time, 24, 30 hours at your destination, which doesn't allow you to adapt. And then you're probably beginning to when you're going back to your home base. So I think the information is there, and I think that the issue is that society and or commercial interests really don't want to change their schedule to adapt to what would probably allow us to function better, both more in health-wise and in the performance of whatever our jobs happen to be.
Thoughts?
Yeah, that's a very good point. And where industry has been approached by scientists in general, the data that are collected from the industry, for example, from the steel industry, provide the industry with very clear evidence that you can reduce the incidence of sick leave, reduce accidents on the job. In hospitals, nursing data are striking in terms of how you can reduce the effects of these negative effects on work by putting people on a different schedule. But in general, the industry feels these are pretty small effects, and it's hard to change the traditions mostly that have been upheld in those industries. So our best options are new factories where things are being started anew. And in some cases, factories where they're realizing that they need a 24/7 workforce, but they're going to be starting it all over again with a new set of skills or something like that, so we can change their schedules.
Is this one of the purposes of your research, gentlemen, that being to determine the kinds of things that we've been talking about here today and then making this kind of information available to business and industry and whomever that might be affected by scheduling?
Well, part of this, and I want to be sure that I thank the American taxpayers, because at one level, many of us are doing, Eric and I are doing basic research, which is we don't really know how the system works, and we're trying to get at it from the most basic level. But understanding like the genes associated with the circadian biology, or understanding the circuits that how those genes are affected by changes in our light dark cycle, can actually go back now into the community and say, okay, this kinds of behaviors could be adjusted and would make for a better, healthier public. You can hear in some cases some of Eric's frustration, which is, the data are very clear that some of these changes would actually benefit business by making their employees healthier, by making their output better. We are trying to get this across at a basic level. So it's a combination of basic research providing the sort of foundation such that we can go back and inform the American public how it is that we're trying to improve how their life is.
Jerry mentioned he worked for the commercial airline industry. And the question I meant to ask earlier relates to why is it more of a problem traveling from, I guess it's west to east as opposed to east to west? What's going on there, Eric?
It's a great question. It's something that's very clearly there in most organisms, not just humans, that is traveling east. So part of it is clearly that you're flying in a direction so that the sun is going to rise earlier. So day is going to come sooner. So you've shortened your night, and if you're a nocturnal sleeping organism, you've cut yourself short on sleep. So many people can feel better on transatlantic flights going east just by getting some sleep on the plane, and that can really help a lot. But in addition, it turns out it is more difficult for the clock to advance, fly east, than fly west. And currently our understanding is that it's because in addition to the SCN, the master circadian clock, as Paul alluded to earlier, there are many clocks in our body. And the ability of our master clock to synchronize all those other clocks in other parts of your brain, in your liver, is set up in such a way that it can delay those clocks more easily than it can advance those clocks.
Can we reassure Rodney as he travels west to east to get back to Edwardsville today that he's not going to have a problem?
The other side of the river.
All right.
Yeah. Sunrise should be pretty similar there.
That should be okay. Okay. I'm sure you feel better, Rodney.
Yes.
Let's take another call. Mike in University City, it's your turn. Go ahead.
Hi, Don.
Hi.
We were discussing this thing with my spouse just a few minutes ago, and she said, look, she's a night person, and she was born in Seattle, and I was born in Germany. I'm a morning person. Is there anything to that, or we're just kidding ourselves?
All right.
So Well, you know, it's probably more related to who your parents and grandparents were, you know, originally, you know, in Seattle versus in Germany, as opposed to the fact that you were born in Seattle or Germany specifically.
But why would the grandparents come into the equation here?
Just what your genetic heritage is.
Because that's all gene.
Yeah. But it's multigenetic, based. Right? So there aren't any sort of single genes, you know, except for these sort of very sort of rare families. But by and large, your sleep's being controlled by multiple genes. So it's not just your parents, it's a sort of longer term genetics of, you know, your population genetics.
Well, are all of my children going to be either day people or night people because they share the same genetic background?
Are all of your children blue eyed?
No.
And that's a relatively simple one where we're talking about sort of recessive genes. So it becomes much more complicated. It's a difficult situation. And what that means to a day and night person, you know, we still don't have really good ways of quantitatively defining that. Outside of some patient families that have very specific early morning schedules or very late schedules, the details of how we differ in the middle aren't quite that clear, but, you know, are something that people are trying to find out exactly what that means.
And I would just refer the caller to a really wonderful online survey you can complete. It's called the Munich Chronotype Survey, developed by a researcher named Till Ronenberg at the University of Munich. And he is surveying people all over the world. And, of course, he's in Germany, so he has a lot of data on wake-up times for people in Germany. And the distribution he gets there is very similar to what he gets to people here in the United States. And it's an interesting distribution. Most of us have a pretty typical wake-up time on our free days, on our Saturdays, with a distribution that can span almost 8 hours. Some people would prefer to wake up much earlier, others much later than the average.
And, of course, the teens, as mentioned earlier, are getting up at 11 o'clock in the morning as opposed to 5:30 when they're going to school. I have an email here as time begins to get away from us. Jeff in St. Louis writes, I have a debilitating muscle condition and have read that a common denominator among those with my diagnosis is a history of poor sleep patterns. The correlation is true for me. Since childhood, I have tended to prefer reading into the wee hours rather than going to bed. My muscle symptoms began in my teen years. Could you comment on this connection?
Sleep disorders are associated with almost every neurologic and neuromuscular disorder. It's an unfortunate correlation at this point that we can't point to causation. However, it is true, as we've pointed out, that the biological clock starts as part of your brain, and if it's disrupted or degenerating, it can lead to other downstream problems.
One other issue, we've got a minute left, that I wanted to get to was the issue of artificial light versus sunlight. You had mentioned, Eric, I think it was you, you know, you should get out and get a little sunlight once in a while. Artificial light, not good enough?
Not good enough. There's a striking study that came out last week showing that people who go camping shift their regular schedule dramatically so that this distribution I just described for you on people waking up at different times becomes much, much tighter. Everybody wakes up early when they go camping. And that's because the strength of the light outside is about 1,000 times brighter than you would experience indoors. We just can't make the sun inside.
A question that came up during one of the breaks, a very quick answer is necessary here. If you don't get any sleep for 24 hours, what happens?
You're tired and you
aren't very productive. That part I know.
You're slow to answer the question.
It's definitely going to affect you above and beyond just being tired.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Well, let's leave it at that. I wish we had more time. It's been a fascinating discussion. I want to thank Eric Herzog for being with us. He is a biology professor at Washington University. Paul Gray is assistant professor of anatomy and neurobiology at Washington University. And Lieutenant Rodney Hall is with the Edwardsville Fire Department. He works that 24-on-48 off shift that we've been talking about during the course of the program. Gentlemen, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Really enjoyed the conversation.
Thank you much.
Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk with Michael McMillan, the new president and CEO of the Urban League of Metropolitan St. Louis. Archived versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.